Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the CRH plc 2018 full year results conference call. For the duration of the call, you will be on listen only. The next voice you will hear will be Albert Manifold. Thank you.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to welcome you to the 2018 results for CRH this morning. My name is Albert Manifold. I'm the Chief Executive of CRH. I'm joined on stage by a number of my colleagues. On my far left, we have Senan Murphy, who is our Finance Director. Next to Senan, we have Keith Haas. Keith is the President of our Building Products business. Anne van de Veede is the President of our Europe Materials business. Beside me here, Randy Lake is the President of our Americas Materials business. The running order this morning is, of course, we're going to go through a brief presentation of the financial results we published this morning. Also want to go through some of the trends that were evident in our business as we delivered those numbers for last year. 2018 is a very busy year for us, actually. A lot of initiatives running through our business, and we want to go through and discuss our progress on some of those. Of course, at the end, as usual, we'll have some Q&A and give you some thoughts about how we feel about 2019. Just some of the key messages here before I pass over to Senan. 2018 was a year of record profit delivery for CRH. Profits of 3.4 billion, 7% ahead of last year, 2017, and margins ahead as well. Very glad to see a lot of strong cash generation out of that EBITDA. Very strong cash generation, 70% of our EBITDA being turned into cash. Of course, a continued focus, as you would expect on CRH, on efficient capital management. We will discuss quite a bit about that during the course of this morning's presentation. A good start to the profit improvement program that we announced at the end of May last year. Senan, maybe over to you to talk about some of the key financial numbers.
Thank you, Albert. Our financial highlights on this slide speak for themselves. Today, we're reporting sales growth of 6% over last year. We're also reporting EBITDA growth of 7% over the prior year. They're headline numbers. If you look at organic growth, or if you look at the like-for-like performance against those numbers, you can see that we've delivered an organic growth of 3% on the sales line. We've also delivered 3% organic growth on the EBITDA line. For us, we think they are good results, especially when you consider the headwinds that we've faced across our business over the last year. You'll all remember that we've had headwinds on the weather front. We've had weather disruption in many parts of our business, particularly during some of the busy seasons. We've also dealt with a spike in input costs across many parts of our business over the last 12 months. We're also reporting earnings per share growth today, which is up to over 3 euros a share. That's a very strong growth, and clearly that reflects the underlying trading performance. Included in that number as well is the gain that we made on the sale of our Allied business, which was completed at the early part of 2018. As the CFO, clearly the number that's on this page that impresses me most, or the one I'm most pleased with, is our cash generation. It's the results in terms of our cash performance. 2.4 billion of cash, as Albert has mentioned in the introduction, generated from our operations. What that 2.4 billion of cash has allowed us to do over the last year is reinvest in our business, but it's also allowed us actually buy back shares. We spent 800 million last year in terms of buying back shares. I'm also pleased to say what it's also allowed us to do is to propose an increase in our dividends of 6% for 2018.
Thanks, Senan. Look, a very brief overview of the key messages and indeed the key financial numbers for 2018. I now want to turn to the trading operations and give you a sense of how those numbers were delivered. Firstly, I want to turn to the Americas and discuss exactly what was behind the delivery of those numbers. I'm going to ask my colleagues, Randy and Keith, to take us through their individual businesses in a moment. First, I want to go through some of the key market backdrops that were there and how we delivered against those numbers. It will come as no surprise to you that there was significant weather disruption across all construction markets in North America last year, and we were impacted by that. However, despite that, we saw quite a favorable economic environment, good GDP growth, good economic activity, and again, continued record job creation. Good momentum in our businesses, particularly in the second half and particularly in the last quarter of the year, was evident, and that's continuing on to 2019. I'm sure the guys will talk more about that. Despite the significant weather disruption and, of course, very significant headwinds on energy costs, I have to say we focus very much inside our business, improving our operations, focusing very much on commercial excellence within our businesses. I think we do get a really good performance across our businesses in 2018 in the U.S. So maybe I might turn to you first, Randy, to take us to our biggest division, the Americas Materials Division.
Yeah, thank you, Albert. We were pleased with the performance in 2018, where we saw sales, EBITDA, and margins move ahead of prior year. And despite some of those significant challenges that Albert referenced, we delivered record margins during the course of the year. On a like-for-like basis, we saw a slight turn backwards in margins, primarily in and around the well-documented weather events in and around Texas, the northeastern part of the United States, and eastern Canada, and certainly the input cost impact in and around our asphalt business, bitumen, diesel, and natural gas. But I would say overall we're very happy with what's happening in regards to the states in particular and their involvement in the infrastructure space. Real active participation in taking ownership of their investments. When you underpin that with the federal program, we're seeing increased bidding activity across all of our markets. And with that increased activity, obviously we're seeing an increase in our backlogs, but more importantly, margins are improving in those backlogs. It's been a busy year, certainly from an integration standpoint. We'll talk a little bit about Ashgrove in a few moments, but integrating Ashgrove along with Suwannee America a full year, happy with the progress there, delivering on our expectations in and around profitability, the identification, and then the delivery of synergy. So off to a good start, good conclusion to 18, good momentum going into 19. Keith?
Thanks, Randy. For our Americas Products Division, it was another strong year like our Americas Materials Division. As a reminder, our business is underpinned by residential and non-residential construction in North America, the United States, and Canada. And as Albert alluded to, there were good market fundamentals there, probably mid-single-digit growth in both of those key markets. We were, however, impacted by the unfavorable weather that's been well documented. We have a lot of business that we do in the first half of the year, so this constrained our ability to demonstrate strong organic growth, you know, behind those market tailwinds. But I'm proud of our teams, you know, that really focused hard on our operations, on commercial excellence, on operating efficiencies and cost reductions. So with a 2% like-for-like growth in our sales for the year, we were able to demonstrate a 6% growth in our like-for-like profitability and good margin improvement for the year. So overall, a very strong performance for our Americas Products team. We did get off to a slow start due to the weather in the first half of the year, but we built momentum through the year. We had an excellent fourth quarter, and that gives us an optimistic outlook for 2019.
Thanks, guys. Good delivery across 2018, and hopefully we can see the same across 2019. Good momentum coming into the year, and certainly a good start to the year as well, thankfully. I now want to turn to Europe and indeed Asia, and before I ask Ani to take us through the materials business, and Keith actually is going to cover off the distribution and products business, again, I just want to give you a backdrop to how the environment in which we traded in across Europe. Actually, it was quite pleasing to see the continued recovery in Europe unfold, and 2018, we saw that happening. Across some of our very big markets, particularly in France, Benelux, Germany, and Poland, we saw some really strong delivery. And of course, down the core eastern axis of CRH, which is very important to high growth, we saw good delivery as well. Really good to see as well, we've been watching it for a number of years evolve slowly, but starting to gain real momentum now is pricing across the cement businesses coming back during 2018, and I'm sure Arnie's going to deal with that during 2019. So good delivery despite cost headwinds that we saw in the businesses again. And again, a good start to the year across Europe. Ollie, maybe you might take us through the materials business, and Keith will take us through the products and distribution.
Absolutely. Pleasure to do so, Albert. So good growth in sales development in Europe as well. So we had a top-line growth of 10% and also followed by a 9% increase in EBITDA. So very pleasing results. Like for like, we had also a good, if you back out the acquisitions, we had a like-for-like of 4% both in top-line growth and in EBITDA. And I consider that a good performance given that you all remember sitting in this room probably what we called the Beast of the East last year, and so we had a slow start of the year. But taking that into account, the cost inflation we had and the energy cost inflation and the Brexit uncertainty, very pleased to have a 4% like-for-like growth. Similarly, good volumes development, especially in the east, Poland, Serbia, Hungary, very good growth over there. Also, beginning of the year, last year, we had a good start with pricing. It accelerated a little bit towards the end, and it is continuing in 2019. All in all, Albert, very pleased with the results for 2018 and hopeful for 2019. How did it go for you, Keith?
Thanks, Palma.
Oh, sorry.
Our trading performance in our Europe Lightside division was very similar to Anna's performance in Europe Materials. We service mostly continental Europe, but about 15% of our business is in markets outside of Europe, Australia and others, and it was a very good year for that. On the continent, we saw good market backdrops in our major economies, and the UK, which is a major market for our Europe Lightside business, was stable, which was probably a little bit better than expected given the uncertainty that's been spoken to about in the UK. So all our businesses within Europe Lightside were able to advance. You know, together we were able to generate a 5% like-for-like improvement in our turnover, a 6% move forward in terms of profitability, and 5% on a like-for-like basis in the division. Our margins were basically in line with prior year, and that I view as a very strong performance because the division faced a number of headwinds on the cost inflation area, primarily in the world of labor, a lot of labor cost input inflation, as well as key raw materials like steel and aluminum. So overall, a very good year for Europe Lightside. Like our Americas business, we finished strong, and again, that points us toward further growth in 2019 in this division. Now, looking at our distribution division, it was a little bit more challenging environment, as you can see by the numbers on the screen. I would point out that while we're reporting a significant decline in profitability and in profit margin, that's really due to one-off items, including the divestment of our Benelux-based DIY business, which was done in July of 2018. Taking that out of the equation and you look on the like-for-like trends, we had good momentum in some of our key markets in Europe, in the Netherlands, and in Germany. Some challenges in some of the other markets, including Switzerland, where, you know, we faced sort of a number of challenges, especially in Switzerland for the last several years, but we started getting that turned around in the second half of the year and saw improving trends in our results coming out of Switzerland in the back half of the year. So overall, on a like-for-like basis, broadly in line in terms of profits and in terms of margins for the year in 2018. As you know, we announced about mid-year last year a strategic review of our Europe distribution operations. We're well advanced in that. It's gone well. It's a very detailed and thorough review of our business. We've made a lot of progress so far. We're not quite concluded, but we're looking at all options in terms of value creation for our shareholders for this division.
Thanks, Keith. And lastly, to our Asian division, our smallest division, it actually represents about 1% of EBITDA. And during 2018, we saw the market recover there in the Philippines in particular, which is what we're talking about here, recover quite well on the back of good, strong residential, non-res, and infrastructure growth. And we saw in our business volumes and prices moving ahead. Unfortunately, we were also hit with the same challenges with regard to cost increases that we saw in Europe and the Americas, and we just failed to be able to pass back on enough of those cost increases to our customers to recover the profitability, and we significantly reduced the profitability and very disappointing performance with regard to the EBITDA delivery, and of course margin got compressed as well. Now, we worked hard during the course of 2018 on our businesses. We've taken a lot of costs out. We're doing a very ambitious program to swap our production from offshore production to onshore production. And as an industry, we're working with the government and have been successful in getting the government to support onshore production of cement and clinker. And we saw the impact of that towards the tail end of last year with an improving situation. And we're confident that 2018 represents the trough in our EBITDA performance in the Philippines, and we expect a recovery during the course of 2019. So that's just a quick summary of the overall trading performance, good performance across the businesses in general. But, of course, let's see how the trading performance moves into financial performance. And, Senator, I might ask you to take us through a few slides to explain that, please.
Yeah, what I'd like to do for the next few slides is really just consolidate or pull together the divisional trading updates that you heard from each of my colleagues here and paint for you the group picture. Starting with, obviously, our EBITDA performance, and you look back in terms of how we've done over the last 12 months. As Albert said in the introduction, record profits this year, just shy of $3.4 billion EBITDA delivered. And that's a 7% growth over prior year. Now, there's a lot of moving parts in that 7% growth, pluses and minuses throughout the year. And what I'd like to do is maybe pick out just a few of the highlights that stand out over the year. Clearly, I'm going to start with organic growth. And if you look at our organic performance across our Americas and our European businesses, in total, that added up to 3%. Or in euro terms, that's about 100 million of organic growth year on year. The other big standout positive year on year is the contribution from acquisitions. This year, we now have a full year earnings from Suwannee, the acquisition we did in Florida. We have a full year earnings from Fels, the German acquisition, or the European acquisition, actually, we did last year. We also have a half-year contribution from Ash Grove, which closed in June of 2018. And then we have 45 bolt-on deals that we added throughout 2018, of which there's a partial year contribution in there. So you can see a big contribution on the acquisition front. Not everything is positive. So when you look at our record profits, obviously you need to take into account some of the headwinds we faced. And currency translation is one of those. So you can see 100 million of headwinds on the currency translation side that we absorbed in arriving at that 3.4 billion. Moving on to our cash performance over the last year. As the CFO in the business, obviously you'd expect me to think about this as the most important metric, or certainly the one that I spend a lot of time looking at. I look at our cash performance on a daily basis around the group. But this is not just a financial measure. All of our operating companies care about cash. Everybody focuses on it. We obviously reward people based on our cash performance. So when you look at our cash performance of 2.4 billion generated over the last year, one of the standout things is the conversion. Conversion from earnings of 3.4 into cash of 2.4. That's north of 70%. So it's another year of very high conversion from earnings into cash. And again, there's a lot of drivers behind that. But a few that stand out really are that we start really in a position where we've got strong quality of earnings. There's a lot of focus around the group on managing our working capital. So clearly that's an area that helps us in terms of delivering that cash performance. Also, we have a healthy balance sheet. And with that healthy balance sheet means that we have normal debt levels. We have a very strong investment grade credit rating, which then all means that we're able to control our interest costs. And that leads to the type of cash generation you see on this page. I mentioned healthy balance sheets. Let's talk about our debt performance over the last 12 months. If you look back on this slide, you see from left to right the movement in debt during 2018. We started out the year at 5.8 billion of debt. That was 1.8 times net debt EBITDA. As I mentioned, we had a very busy year on the divestment front and also on the acquisition front. And you can see that we have 1 billion of cash outflow net between acquisitions and divestments over the year. But what stands out, what's most important on this slide, is that strong cash generation that we talked about, 2.4 billion of cash. What that has allowed us to do is reinvest in our business, but it has also allowed us to give back 1.3 billion of cash to our shareholders in the form of dividends and in the form of buybacks. And with all those moving pieces, we still ended the year at just under 7 billion of debt. And just under 2.1 times net debt EBITDA. And that level of debt for us is something that we think about as a comfort level within CRH.
Thanks, Anna. Look, I think when you see that performance being translated into that type of financial performance, despite the progressive change you see in CRH, despite the dynamic change you see around us, there's one constant about CRH, that commitment to strong, strict financial discipline that runs through our balance sheet and our cash generation. It's never changing and really important to our investment story and really important to us as a business. 2018 is interesting to look at. It is a record year of profitability, but it is only a snapshot in time. It doesn't tell you anything about the story of CRH in terms of where we've come from and where we're going to. And what I'd like to do over the next few slides is explain to you exactly where our plans are as we step and push on with the next phase of growth for CRH. But to do that, I've got to go back to the past just to set the scene. This slide here looks at our performance over the last 5 years. And you can see a very significant change in pace and delivery within the business. Increased revenues, profitability, improved margins, improved cash, and improved returns. Now, of course, the markets recovered during that period of time. But the markets didn't recover to that pace. We repositioned, we redeveloped, we reorientated, and we have improved our business during the course of the last 5 years. And of course, for us, the key thing we focus on is returns and cash in CRH, the true measure of any investment. And you can see over that five-year period, we've actually doubled our cash generation and we've improved our overall returns by 370 basis points. And the importance of this slide is not to say a pat on the back and a job well done. That's yesterday's news. It's to illustrate to you the momentum that is there within our business. And that momentum carries us forward, the work we're doing and the work we're going to do as we push on to the next phase of growth. Interesting to look inside that to see exactly where that was delivered. Look at the organic growth within our business. And this is against the backdrop of a fairly anemic, flat Europe over the last 5 years. Of course, there was some recovery in the US, but look at 3% solid CAGR organic top-line growth. And happily turning that with 25% leverage into an EBITDA CAGR over the last 5 years of almost 10%. A really strong performance in our core heritage businesses. Of course, we've been very active on the acquisition front, good or inorganic growth. We acquired businesses that last year contributed almost $1.5 billion of EBITDA. About 50% of that came in Europe, about 50% of that came in the US. That balance is important to us. But interestingly, of course, you can see the EBITDA margin, accretive to the overall group margin and part of the overall improvement story within CRH. Senna, you might take us through some of the financial impacts of the last 5 years and how we've dealt with them.
The strong financial discipline has been a hallmark of CRH over the last number of decades. And I think if you look back here specifically over the last 10 years and look at our net debt to EBITDA ratio, it comes out at 2x. And despite the acquisitions that Albert talked about on the last slide over the last 5 years, we've still maintained a very healthy balance sheet. You can see in 2015, we actually stretched our balance sheet to be able to afford the acquisition of the Lafarge Wholesome assets and also to be able to afford the acquisition of C.R. Laurence. And the important thing is that within 12 months, we had paid our debt down to normal levels again. So we're back at normalized levels. So when you look at that metric, I think what's important is, you know, going forward, that strong financial discipline is something that is still remains here in CRH today and is something that we're wedded to going forward. But look at our cash generation. Look back over the last 5 years on cash. Generated over $10 billion of cash. Again, that's on approximately, you know, $2 billion a year, or just over $2 billion a year in terms of the average cash generated over that period. What that past performance does for us is it gives us confidence about the cash targets that we've set for ourselves as you look out over the next 3 years. But also what's really important about that cash performance is that it gives us optionality going forward. It gives us optionality in terms of how we create and maximize value for shareholders, be that in the form of acquisitions or investing in our business, or be that in terms of returning cash to shareholders.
Thanks, Dan. So we set the scene, record profits in 2018, good delivery across the last 5 years, and good momentum coming into the business. And the question now for us and for you, our shareholders, is how are we going to use that momentum going forward to build further value as we push on to the next phase of growth? So against that backdrop, I just want to set out for you what we consider to be some of our key strategic priorities or objectives and how we think about the business. They haven't changed in the last 5 years, and they underpin how we think about the next few years. First and foremost, portfolio management. You have seen us actively manage our capital base during the course of the last 5 years, and that, of course, is going to continue. Very important as we reposition the business towards higher growth areas. You've seen our unerring, relentless focus on the efficient allocation of capital, either internally and last year externally, for the value creation for our shareholders. But at the bedrock of it all, the simple principle that we have had in CRH for decades, we build better businesses. The most sustainable competitive advantage in any business is continuous business improvement. Because every year you move the goalposts, you get better and everybody is chasing you. And that is embedded deeply within CRH and is what will lead to structurally higher returns, margins and cash for us in CRH in the years ahead. So how have we been doing against these particular objectives over the last number of years? Well, the portfolio is probably known to most of you. Of course, some of the areas may be not immediately obvious. We have shrunk down from 7 divisions of 2012-2013 down to the 3 core divisions now at this stage. We have gone narrower and deeper. And look at some of the numbers there. 1/3 of all the businesses we owned in 2013 have been disposed of. Over half the profitability of last year in a record year were delivered with businesses we acquired in the last 5 years. And our program continues on and continues on. That efficient use of our capital base, allocating, reallocating, is very important as we drive value in our business going forward. The allocation of capital both within our portfolio and without. We have dispersed $3 billion of our shareholders' cash back to them over the last 5 years. That's what companies should do. We generate an enormous amount of cash on an annual basis, and we want to give it back to shareholders in either share price growth, profitable growth, or cash disbursements back to them, and we've been committed to doing that for the last number of years. And finally, this commitment to continuous business improvement. You can see the improvements we've had in the business for the last 5 years. The market didn't deliver that. We delivered that within our businesses. And, of course, we've now, last year, announced a further program for profit improvement. And turning to that profit improvement program, last May, we announced a target to increase our margins by 300 basis points going forward. Now, we didn't just dream this up. This was well thought out
and it has been enabled by the portfolio review in the reshaping of our businesses back into certain three core markets where we have a unique core competency in those three divisions. And those three divisions just don't stand alone. They are businesses that drive value for our shareholders by the way they interact with each other, the way they supply product to each other, the way they provide best practice and knowledge sharing across the businesses, the way they service the market, and the way they innovate to develop future opportunities together. And even within the divisions themselves, that relentless pursuit we have to vertical integration, the key differentiating factor for CRH is how vertically integrated our businesses are, more so than any other business in the building materials space. We drive value up and down the chain and grab value and profits all the way all the way through the chain as we do that. And actually, that's what the magic dust of CRH is all about. It's not about the people on this stage today, because we change every few years. It's the business model that CRH has that consistently delivers industry-leading returns and cash generation year after year. And the answer is in the business model that we have. So we have a clear model in place, but we also have a clear plan to improve upon that model. And we announced that last year. And we're looking at this, have this morning, three of the key people who are responsible for delivering that plan with their teams. So I'm going to ask Randy first, and then Anne and Keith to take us through the areas that they've got primary responsibility for. So Randy first, you're leading the charge on procurement. Maybe you want to just take us through your thoughts and your plans in that area.
I'd say we're well pleased with the progress so far in 2018 leading into 19 in and around the concept of global procurement. We really view that as a key strategic lever to delivering and helping to deliver on the 300 basis point improvement. And the reason we believe that is actually because we've experienced it so far, even in work that's been done through 2018. So we know when we manage our spend and coordinate that spend centrally, we deliver higher savings, roughly 2 to 4% higher savings than if those same items were procured locally. And it's all about really category management. And I often say, you know, we organize ourselves globally but activate locally. So we've built our teams from a group to a division level to interact closely with our operating entities. And those teams are delivering everything from global IT licensing agreements to coal for our U.S. cement operations, but real tangible results that our operating folks can see, taste, and feel that builds adoption and allows us to continue to create momentum. And thus far, through 2018 going into 19, we've identified just north of 100 million euro savings in terms of procurement over the next 3 years.
Similar to you, Randy, I see a lot of opportunities in process improvement by leveraging our group expertise. A good example for me is logistics. Up until recently, we were very locally managed. Every group company was doing it on its own. We have now a much more concentrated approach and coordinated approach, and we're using and sharing best practices. So good opportunities there to reduce our cost and optimize our service delivery. But also in energy and energy saving of energy, reducing energy cost and usage. We've invested more in 2018 in AFR platforms. We've increased our capability to use AFRs, and we're targeting another 10 million euros in savings in 2019 alone. But also more classic, we're optimizing our footprint. We closed one of our smaller production facilities in Poland, and we're concentrating at the more efficient facilities. And by doing so, we improve our competitive position. Over to you, Keith.
Thanks, Anna. Along with the procurement and process savings that Randy and Anna outlined, which really cut across all our businesses, structural cost improvements are going to play a big role in our profit improvement program moving forward. And these structural cost savings are really enabled and driven by the fact of what Albert talked about, going from 7 divisions a number of years ago now to 3 divisions, which are larger, more integrated platforms of scale. And this simpler organization format is allowing us to really reorganize our management structures, streamline our supporting functions, you know, from the operating company level all the way up to the center, and consolidate our regional network of offices that supported a more regionally operated business. And as we look through that, we've identified up to 100 million euros of structural cost savings out of the organization. Implementation of those plans began last year, and so far we're progressing well.
Thanks, Keith. Look, you've seen exactly the plans that have kicked off. There's good progress work that's been taken. One thing I want to say is that about 70% of the initiatives that we're taking to deliver those 300 basis points are internal to us. They are within our control, that we have the chance and the power and the opportunity to deliver. And that's really comforting for us as we go forward. Just one last area we want to cover is where are we now as a company in terms of our positioning in the markets that we're in? Because the CRH of 2019 is a very different CRH to the CRH of 2015 or indeed 2013. As Keith has said, we've been reorganized from 7 divisions back now to 3 divisions, focused on an area of core competency, much more focused, and now with profit improvement program focusing on areas such as increased efficiency, increased productivity, and increased effectiveness in how we service our customers and our markets, very much being at the fore of what we do. So I thought it worthwhile, as we have our colleagues here, to take us through their individual businesses and how they are thinking about the position of the businesses in the markets that they're in and how they think about their opportunities going forward. So first, Randy, I'm going to turn to you, run our largest business, America's Materials, and just take us through your thoughts in terms of the next few years for the materials business.
Yeah. You certainly would be well familiar with America's Materials. We are the number one building materials business in North America, a very large footprint across 44 states and 8 Canadian provinces, and I think really highlighted by the investment in long-term reserves in those key markets. I think over the years, we've done a good job at not only driving regional balance, but I think more importantly, balance in terms of end-use exposure. And the map on the right-hand side kind of talks or tries to explain a little bit of that. If you look in the northeastern part of the U.S., it's our largest and most profitable market across all of AMET, really characterized by densely populated areas, a large infrastructure system, harsh winters, drives a large amount of repair and maintenance activity. And so for our business there, it's just a consistent delivery of returns and cash. As you move down into what I call the Smile States and up to the Pacific Northwest, places like Florida and Texas, Washington and Oregon, there's a little different dynamic there. It's high population growth. Florida is growing at 3 times the rate of the national average. More folks moving into those particular areas. So the market is more descriptive of residential and non-res construction. We have good positions in those particular markets to be able to build upon and take advantage, but it's a great complement to what's happening in the Northeast. And then in the central part of the United States, I would call that stable. We have had long-term positions there. We have an opportunity to build on those positions through the Ash Grove acquisition, but those markets kind of consistently deliver year in and year out as well, but a different dynamic than the other parts of the U.S. And I think as they work together, as it does economies all over the world, the state's economies are slightly different, and I think that's important in regards to the ability for us to deliver consistent returns and cash. Certainly, the vertical integration model is important. We have done this for years in terms of building our position around aggregate. In the last 18 months, significant investments allowing us to do that in the cement business as well. And really, I think that positioned us in some of those high-growth markets to take advantage of the dynamics that are happening, again, in the South and up into the Pacific Northwest. When you look forward, especially in just the nature of our business and the aggregate business in particular, 70% of the aggregate reserves and production are still in the hands of private entities. Most of those are integrated. They're integrated into ready-mix businesses or asphalt business. They look much like ourselves. So it gives us a unique perspective, I think a competitive advantage as we look to continue to consolidate markets within the U.S. And I think fundamentally, if you believe in the U.S. construction fundamentals and you look at our portfolio of businesses there and really believe from a long-term cash and returns standpoint, we're well positioned. Talked a little bit about the nature of vertical integration, and we tried to depict this on the left-hand side. We really have a unique integrated approach compared to our most natural peers, who are primarily in the aggregate space. If you look at the chart there, 15% of our revenues are derived from the sale of aggregate versus 60 to 75% on our peer group. That integrated model, we believe, gives us a competitive advantage and insights into the market. I'd say 3 things in particular. 1, commercial insights. So we understand what the customer wants and expects. We understand the levers that are required in individual markets to drive performance. From an operational standpoint, the idea of base loading a more heavily capitalized business such as cement or aggregate is important to have that drives efficiency and improvement in your plant and consistency in those plants. And from a customer standpoint, we understand the products and services that our customers need, but I think more importantly, we provide an integrated solution specifically in and around the infrastructure space that that no one else can deliver on. And I think, you know, from that standpoint, it's unique, but moving to the right-hand side, it doesn't matter, and oftentimes I'd say people look at the margins in our business and say, well, they're slightly lower than your direct peers. Well, our focus is on cash and returns. We think the vertical integration model is the best way to deliver on that. It doesn't mean we don't manage our business by line of business. So on the right-hand side, we show a comparison for gross margin in regards to our aggregate business. And you can see 28% gross margin. I would call that best in class when compared to the two largest peers of ours in that space. But at the end of the day, the model is, and our model, is about driving shareholder value in and around returns and cash. The vertical integration drives superior performance there. I think part of that is certainly that internal focus that Albert talks about, continuous improvement. The other way for us to drive value is the creation of platforms. And over the last 18 months, we've been fortunate enough to acquire the Ashgrove business, a full year of Suwannee America. You combine that with the Canadian cement business, we have a leadership position now in North America. It's given us exposure to those faster-growing markets in Florida and Texas, Utah, and up in the Pacific Northwest. But I think really important, we'll talk about this a little bit, is the overlap and the ability for us to self-supply. Again, hallmarks of that vertical integration model. We are the largest consumer and purchaser of cement in North America, so we have a significant opportunity there to benefit from this platform, but also to fill in the gaps in that central part of the United States where it's a tremendous overlap with Ashgrove and our existing footprint. And we talk about Ashgrove, and I mentioned earlier we're on track delivering as expected from a profitability standpoint. We announced at the end of last year $100 million of synergies. Happy to say this morning we've identified another $10 million, primarily in and around the commercial procurement and G&A space, with maybe an unequal weighting on the operational side. And just a thanks to Ani and his team. When we began to integrate this business, just the technical expertise that we have around Europe and Asia and Ani's team, not only helping us to evaluate the deal, but then to begin to execute, it's really boots on the ground. So we have people embedded in our business from Ani's team. So Ani, I just thank you and your team for the help in letting us accelerate performance there.
All right. Pleasure to do so, Randy. And maybe that's much easier for me to do because, in a way, your business is so similar to ours, actually. Like you, we have a very much an integrated business model, and we are number one in a lot of positions we are in the Northern Europe. An attractive footprint, and like Randy has an area in the east, we have the area in the west where we have more stable markets, continuous growth, especially focusing on the RMI. And I don't have a smile state, but I have the east, and the eastern markets have a much better growth, up to 5% and above. And that has also worked out during the last year where we had the eastern region performing very well with especially Poland and Romania and Serbia and Hungary growing very well. So if I move on, like you, Randy, we have a very uniquely integrated model. And I took here the comparison of cement like you did for aggregates. We have about 20% revenue generation from cement, whereas our peers typically have between 45 and 60, as you can see right here. But if you look at our margins, we are very competitive, like in the case of aggregates. Our margins are at par or better than the competition, and I think that is at the core of what we are doing in CRH, an integrated business model. We want to make sure that we secure our base load, and that we invest also in addition to what Randy was saying before, that we make sure that we can always sell our product, that we have a good utilization of our assets, and that's why we invest in other businesses and integrate them. And I would like to remind you, these businesses have a much lower capital requirement than all the other businesses. So we compete line for line for businesses, is this cement, aggregates, ready mix, whatever we do, but combined, what we are doing is we're competing and achieving and targeting return on assets and generating cash.
Yeah, moving from our materials businesses to our building products businesses, it's an exciting development that we have now a unified and single building products division within CRH. And I just want to take a few moments, maybe give a snapshot of what that division looks like and a bit of the road ahead for it. So it's a big group. We're about 10 billion euro in sales, broken into four major product platforms, as you see on the graphic there. About 80% of our EBITDA and profits is derived from the three sort of legacy building products platforms that we had, doing very similar things in Europe and in North America. Our first would be our infrastructure products platform, where we engineer and manufacture both enclosures and structures, primarily for the protection and the delivery of critical utilities like water, electric, and telecoms, but also structures for transportation infrastructure. Our architectural products business designs and manufactures innovative products that are really geared toward the improvement of the exterior built environment, with one of our biggest markets being the outdoor living space. And finally, our building envelope group, which again designs, engineers, and manufactures high performance and customized enclosures that close the building envelope, close out the structure of a building, primarily for non-residential markets, but also a growing residential business. And sort of taken together again, it's 10 billion euros in revenue, very good market positions in many parts of the world, and very strong performance over the last 5 years. But kind of why are we putting this together as one division? And I think it's really about repositioning CRH for the changing needs of the construction world. You know, there's a lot of trends that are happening around us that are requiring us to adapt and evolve. You know, some of those would be the fact we have labor shortages, you know, in our markets and primarily in our customers. So we have to adapt to bring products to market that ease and speed up the pace of construction on job sites. You know, within that, there's a demand from our customers and from owners in general for more integrated, you know, products and solutions and logistics from major suppliers like CRH. And as you well know, you know, there's more demanding environmental and regulatory factors that feature into our products, which actually increases the performance of buildings, and that's pushed back onto companies like us to come up and design and bring to market those types of solutions. We've had lots of very good businesses, pockets of excellence around the world, but we've approached the addressing of these needs and the evolution of our business in a bit of a fragmented and regional manner. And the trends that we're seeing are really global. They're running at different pace in different parts of the world, but they're happening everywhere. And so for us to take full advantage of it and generate the highest cash and returns we can for CRH, we view that to bring this into a unified, more singular approach in terms of strategy and execution to address these needs through our building products division is the best route forward for us. So what are some of the features of this division as we get started? It's effective January 1st, and what we'll be looking for is kind of full leverage of our scale, you know, which allows us a broad reach, but also procurement advantages, process advantages like we talked about before, and our capabilities, our talents within our organizations, our product development and branding and operational capabilities. Increased integration of our businesses, Albert spoke about it, you know, and that's integration within the building products division, but businesses that make that up in terms of how they bring solutions to customers together, but also tighter integration and better integration with our materials businesses, both in the Americas and in Europe, where we can capitalize and take advantage not only of the great market positions that our businesses have in Randy and Anna's world, but also that pull-through demand, you know, that from upstream in their businesses, downstream through the businesses in my division to increase overall volumes and returns for CRH. And you think about what role does building products play for CRH? And I think it's quite important that we're aligned to attractive markets. You know, our business, as I spoke about before, is driven by the non-residential and residential above-ground construction markets primarily. And that provides good balance and good growth prospects through the cycle. And, you know, as it counterbalances the more infrastructure-focused businesses in Randy and Anne's world. And our businesses, one feature then would be kind of a lower level of capital intensity, kind of like the downstream products you spoke about, Anne, where we have the ability, once we have established positions, to generate very attractive returns over the cycle, and given the low capital intensity, very high conversion of profitability into free cash. And so as we look forward in terms of value creation for building products, you know, what we'll see is, again, as I spoke, an increased integration of all of our businesses. And through this, we'll be providing that bundling of logistics, services, and a wide range of products that, quite frankly, our customers are demanding, and our customers are increasingly global, and that, therefore, it's raising the bar of execution for us. And we see within the division significant value creation opportunities over the long term. You know, we have great businesses, but they still have room to run to achieve their full potential in existing geographies. And also, as the needs of our customers and the circumstances in the world change, we will grow into new geographies and new adjacent product spaces that continues the evolution of our businesses to create continuous value and create more cash and profitability for the company moving forward. And everything we do in building products is completely aligned with CRH's core capability around buying good businesses, building them into strong integrated platforms, and driving continuous business performance through them over time. Senator?
Thanks, Keith. It's good to hear an update from you on our new building products division, and especially to hear about the value creation opportunities you see ahead. So I'd like to just use the last few slides here to look forward now. And this slide specifically here, I'd like to use this to talk about our capital allocation thoughts as we look forward. It's important to say up front that any of our capital allocation thoughts or conversations are all really motivated around creating value for shareholders or maximizing value for shareholders. So it's important to say up front, we have a healthy balance sheet today. We intend to keep it that way going forward. That's a priority for us. So maintaining the health of the balance sheet, maintaining our investment grade rating is important to us. Now, we are throwing off a lot of cash, and that's a fantastic opportunity for us. That gives us optionality as we look forward. On the one hand, we can use some or all of that cash to reinvest in our business or to acquire capital, you know, or returns accretive businesses going forward. On the other hand, we can think about giving some or all of that cash back to shareholders in the form of dividends or in the form of buybacks. Specifically on dividends, what we're happy to reiterate is our progressive approach towards dividends. So as we grow our earnings, as we look out over the coming years, we intend to keep growing our dividends. We keep on building back our cover. Our cover today is at 2.5 times. And as you look out over the coming years, we intend to keep building that cover so that we can continue to be able to maintain or increase dividends into the future, just like we did over the last 40 years. On buybacks, over the last year, we did $800 million of buybacks. We announced another $200 million before Christmas. We have 100 done, as Albert said, as of today. The remainder of that will be completed by the end of March. Buybacks now are an ongoing part of the way we think about capital allocation going forward. So it's there for us to think about it. And when this phase of the program is over, we'll be back to you to update you in terms of further phases. Obviously, we'll go through approvals at our AGM in terms of getting approval from our shareholders to be able to issue and buy back more shares. But that should be something that you think about from us going forward, where we will constantly update you in terms of how we're doing.
Thanks, Senna. So just to conclude, you've seen the performance of 2018, a really good, strong year. We've shown you what we've done for the last 5 years, and you can see the momentum that's been in our business, and it continues forward for the next phase of growth of CRH. We've shared with you, as we have before, our guiding principles and how we think about the strategy of our business, and indeed how the short-term issues we're thinking about as we work forward and to deliver this 300 basis points improvement. All of it focused on one thing, driving returns and cash to drive shareholder value. That is our relentless, unerring focus within CRH, and it will remain so. Just specifically with regard to 2019, as you would have picked up from some of the comments, we've got off to a good start, actually. The momentum of last year in both our major markets in the Americas and Europe has been good, and we think it will continue on. Of course, we'll update you as we go through the year regularly, but off to a good start. We're very much focused on terms of focusing on the continuous business improvement programs we have in our businesses. Building better businesses is fundamental to what we do in CRH, and none more so than now. We have specific programs in place to deliver over the next 3 years, and it's to work with that now we go, and we'll update you during the course of this year and the next 2 years following on our progress on that journey. But of course, underpinning it all, as Senator has said, an absolute relentless focus on strong financial discipline, maintaining the optionality that that balance sheet gives us, and of course, focusing on increasing and improving our very good and solid cash flow through our businesses. And we're confident 2019 will be another year of progress for CRH. So that's the end of this part of the presentation this morning. We're now going to move to Q&A. If I can ask you in the room, please, just to give your name and the name of your institution when you ask your question, because there are people watching down the line. I'm also conscious of the fact that more and more people are dialing into this, so I want to give sufficient time at the end of the presentation for that as well. So we'll just move to the first question here, please. Yeah, it's coming.
Hi, thanks and good morning. Elodie Hall from JP Morgan. Thanks for taking my questions. So my first question would be on Cevian Capital, since they took a stake in your capital earlier this year. Can you comment if you had any discussion with them? I mean, I would appreciate any comments that you'd have on that. And my second question is on your U.S. outlook. You're talking about trends to stay or volumes to grow at similar pace as last year. But last year you had some weather impact. So could you quantify that weather impact and how that comes into play in your guidance for 2019? Thank you.
Okay, so two questions there. One was about commenting about any comments with regard to Cevian Capital's investment in Sirius and any discussions we may have had with them, and also about the outlook for the U.S. performance this year in terms of versus last year, and also about the weather outlook, weather impact on last year. I think that was the question. So I'll ask Senna maybe at the end to come back and talk about that. And then before that, I'll ask Rand to comment on the outlook for volumes and prices, and I'll deal with the question with regard to Cevian. We have many investors in our business, and we speak to all investors. I have absolutely no intention of discussing the discussions I have with individual investors. Nobody would want that. Nobody down the line would want me discussing with anybody else what we talk to them about individually. We are an independent business focused on delivering value through the creation of better cash flow and higher returns for all our shareholders. That remains a simple focus. Nothing changes before or after any investor comes or goes, because we have a clear plan in place to deliver that. The numbers last year are a record performance for CRH. We produce industry-leading returns, industry-leading cash, and we have a plan to improve upon that, and that's where our focus is going to be on our business going forward. And we openly engage with all shareholders with a view towards doing that, and we intend to continue to do that. Maybe I might turn to you, Randy, in terms of volumes and prices for this year, expectations.
Yeah, hopefully we tried to describe a little bit with the map that I walked through. Obviously, there's differences in terms of the rate of growth based upon kind of the makeup of those markets. And so I would say, you know, on average, it's going to be low single digits in, on the aggregate side as well as on the pricing side. But you, as you can assume, that rate of growth will be higher in the Smile States and out in the Pacific Northwest. We tend to spend a lot of time with our customer base. Obviously, a big part of our customer base are the DOTs. So we have clarity in regards to what projects are coming up, and that's transparent on a state-by-state basis. But interaction with our customers across the entire platform of the business, we'd be comfortable with you know, stating the low single-digit growth of pricing and volumes. You'd certainly would see different words from folks that we would compete with within the U.S., but I think our information from our customer base really gives us clarity about what will happen in the 19th.
And just on weather, to address that, probably the easiest way to think about weather is it had an impact across, obviously, many parts of our business over the last year. And the way I probably articulate it best is operating leverage. Our operating leverage for the group in 2018 was 11%. If I take Asia out of that, it was 14% for the Americas and Europe. And we would have expected that to be north of 20% in a normal environment. So really what weather is showing you is the impact in terms of the operating leverage across the business in terms of performance. And I'd say, obviously, operating leverage is something you should look at over multiple years rather than any one year, but that probably gives you an indication of what impact the weather had for us this year.
Yeah, morning, everyone. So it's Paul Roger from Exam BNP. A couple of questions. Firstly, Albert, maybe to push you a bit more on being a bit specific on the guidance. And I think you've historically said, you know, this is a business that typically does sort of 5% like-for-like EBITDA. You did 3% last year. Sorry, I don't know if that's generous or not. But my question basically is you've got the easy base, as Eldis said. You've got less cost inflation. You've got the type of operating leverage that Senna's talking about. I guess the overall question is there any reason why you can't do sort of high single digits or quite a lot better than historically? And then the second question is maybe for Arne. It's on heavy side pricing in Europe. I think you mentioned there was an acceleration out of 2019. I wonder if you can be a bit more specific in terms of the magnitude and if there's any reason really why Europe overall can't ultimately get that sort of 30% operating leverage that we've seen in the last 5 years in the US. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. So two questions there, one in relation to guidance this year and then about to Arne about pricing. I'll just give some thoughts on that myself before I pass it to Arne. We're sitting here at the end of February. The year has to run out ahead of us and let's see what it brings. What we can say, you're absolutely right. The momentum is good within our businesses. We have a number of factors that are tailwinds within our business this year that were headwinds last year. Energy probably should be a tailwind for our business this year. It was a very significant headwind last year. We have the full-year contribution of Ash Grove coming in. There was only 6 months last year. We have initiatives running through our business to improve our businesses. So we've set ourselves very ambitious targets, but what that is going to be and what that's going to deliver, let's see how the year rolls out. And we're quite good. As we get towards the end of the year, we get very specific and narrow towards our guidance, because it really takes us to get past the interims at the end of August into that August, September, October period before we actually get real visibility as to what the year is going to be. And we try to be precise about that. Other than up to that point in time, it's just conjecture, actually. Just before I pass to Anya specifically on the pricing, just a comment I've made before on pricing in Europe, and I've made it for several years, and it's true. If one goes back to the late 1990s and into the early 2000s, there used to be parity between US dollar pricing of cement and Euro pricing of cement as well. And then, of course, what happened is this dislocation during the global financial crisis, and indeed after the global financial crisis, as the US recovered quickly, the US has sped on to ahead now, where US cement is trading at $110, $115 a ton. And Europe generally is wallowing somewhere between 45 to 65. So my own contention would be that given the level of investment in cement business, because as my colleagues have mentioned, one of the reasons why the cement businesses need very high margins is because they're so capital intensive and they eat cash. Cement businesses eat cash. One of the reasons why we produce so much cash is actually because we don't have a big preponderance of cement business. That's how we can generate the cash that's there. But you need to have higher pricing in Europe to pay for the investments that are in the ground. And I do believe the market owes us, over time, 30 to 40 euros a ton to bring us back to what would be the parity we had and existed for 30 or 40 years. With regard to the specific markets, I don't expect you to go to 15 markets only, but just directionally how you feel the pricing will go in 2019.
Well, I would like to talk about 15. No, 9 out of 15, we had a price increase in 2017. We increased that to 12 countries out of 15 in 2018. And so clearly the target is to get to 15 out of 15 countries price increase, and not only that we want to cover the 100%, but also, as you were saying, to increase the quantum of the price increase, and I see good opportunities to do that, actually. We were a little bit helped by the good fourth quarter and the relatively good weather, so that helped with the price discussion, which you usually have end of the year, beginning of the year. So we have made good progress in the discussions, and the only thing that is holding back maybe the 15th country is that in all the countries we have long-term contracts, and in this specific case, Switzerland, we have longer-term contracts, which is more difficult to increase prices, but on the free volume, we see very reasonable price increases.
Okay. Bob, sorry, just get the microphone here.
Morning, Robert Carter from Davy. So two for me. So one maybe just to go back on price cost, particularly in the United States, and the energy benefits that you might see there, especially in your asphalt business with lower bitumen, lower natural gas prices. Just wondering, Randy, is you know, in terms of how that's gone with Winterfell, how your projects look with the DOT, is there any big potential benefit coming there? And two, I just want to go back on vertical integration, especially in the context of the slides where you showed your ags and your cement margin relative to peers. And I'm just wondering, again, if you'd give us some practical kind of color on the benefits of being vertically integrated relative to those peers and you know, how they accrue to CRH. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Bob. Two questions there. One about the energy benefits. It's impossible to give a sense of what the energy benefits are going to be this year because the market is yet to play out. But specifically with regard to Winterfell and how the Winterfell program is going, I'll ask Randy to update on that, and then I'll come back at the end. Your question was about integration and margins within integrated businesses, I think. So, Randy, just in terms of how Winterfell is going and just how it's being on so far.
Yeah, I think a couple points, Bob, there to clarify. Certainly crude has come down. I think crude in the last quarter, in the early part of this year, came down roughly 38%. But the rack pricing for bitumen only moved 4% down. So what people were actually buying bitumen for is not directly linked with the price of crude. So I would say a couple of different things in and around that. One, you know our business well. Certainly a third of what we do is we don't kind of avert risk because of the winter storage that we have. A third of that is de-risked because of the state indexes, and then a third of our asphalt is kind of to play for in the market. In reference to Winterfell, I would say it's broadly similar to what it was last year, because you have to remember some of the challenges that we had in regards to just selling and laying asphalt meant that we were carrying a little bit more inventory going into the latter half of the year. And so from a total cost basis, it's roughly flat with last year. But we'll see our contracts. You know, the contracts that we're bidding now would be reflective of the current market price of bitumen, and I would expect there to be advancements, you know, as we go into the season in 2019.
Thanks, Randy. And specifically with regards to the question on margins, I think margins are very interesting, provided you're comparing similar businesses, provided you're comparing apples with apples. The sewerage business model, as most people will know, it's a very different model to anybody else. We choose not to have a monolithic, heavily capital-intensive cement or aggregate business because we run those businesses, and it's extremely hard to produce returns and cash in those businesses. As I said to you, heavily high capital-intensive businesses eat and consume cash. We choose to have an integrated model, which is a very different model, a more balanced model that delivers all through the line, but delivers sustainably higher returns and cash, as our colleagues have shown to you. And year after year, sewerage does that. You saw four competitors there. I'm not going to name them publicly on stage there, but you can work out who they are. The four of the biggest companies in the world. And yet, for year after year, we produce higher returns and higher cash than they do. Well, why is that? It's the business model. The fact that the lower capital intensity downstream gives you a proportionately higher margin and gives you higher returns and higher cash. And until our shareholders tell us something else, we are going to focus on returns and cash. And that business model is what underpins CRH going forward. Yes, margins are important, but we compare our business on a line-to-line basis, as my colleague said, on a margin. But as an overall business, the judge of ourselves or any investment is returns on cash. And that's how CRH wins, hands down, year after year.
Thank you. It's John Fraser-Andrews, HSBC. Two questions for me, please. The first one in American Materials. You mentioned earlier that the margins in the backlogs are higher. And Randy, you just said that you got a small tailwind from the bitumen cost. Can you elaborate on other costs? So diesel soared last year. What the impact is from cost inputs and to what extent it's pricing as well? And then the second question is for Senan. In the cash generation, the sort of key inputs of what's draining the EBITDA, are there any advances you see in working capital, interest expenses, or sort of further getting the tax rate down, which are going to help that cash conversion? Thank you.
I really love you, Randy. Another question for American Materials. Before I pass it to you, Senan, you might just have a comment on that.
I'll start off with the second question there, John. In terms of working capital, I think we've made a lot of progress over the last 3 or 4 years in terms of our working capital, in terms of bringing that down as a percentage of sales. And you've seen over the last year, while there was an outflow in the full year, that outflow was really driven mostly by the growth in sales. So we continue to be very focused on that. I wouldn't be expecting or anticipating that you'll see a further reduction in working capital as a percentage of sales going forward. So what we have, we'll hold and obviously stay focused on that. I think in terms of interest costs, our interest costs next year are expected to go up by about 10 to 15%. Main reason, we have a little bit more debt on the balance sheet now. We would have issued $1.5 billion of long-term money during 2018 at a rate between 3.5% and 4%. So that comes into the equation. We also had a lot of cash on the balance sheet, as you recall, in the first 6 months of 2018 because we had the proceeds from Allied and we didn't close out on Ashgrove until the half year. Tax. The effective tax rate this year is 23%. That's great progress from where it was 2 years ago, which was we were up in the 27s, 28s. I'd hold it at 23% going forward. That's now reflective of, obviously, the reform of U.S. tax coming through and the footprint of businesses we have today.
And diesel cost and in terms of, again, the utilization going forward.
Yeah, I guess a couple different pieces there. One, as we've seen, we track this certainly on a weekly, a daily, if not weekly basis in terms of overall bidding activity. So overall bidding activity has improved, which in turn has allowed us to grow our backlogs, but more importantly to be targeted in terms of what type of jobs we will execute on. We have more flexibility there. So certainly the margins are improving in the backlog. That work typically is 6 to 9 months out. We'll get some advantage of that in 2019. I think it bodes a little better for 2020, though, as well. And when I talk about energy input costs, certainly bitumen is a big part of that, diesel as well. We would say that's going to be broadly flat as we go into 2019, and our pricing in and around aggregate in particular, which uses a good bit of off-road diesel, we should see progress there. So I'd say, you know, all in all, still a lot to play for, John, but I would anticipate benefits in the latter half of the year, going into 2020.
I'm going to go to this side of the room, if you don't mind, David.
Dave O'Brien from Goodbody. Firstly, on M&A, if I could, please, a step up in the level of bolt-on activity into the mid-40s, and particularly on American Materials, we're now about half of that. Are we already seeing the benefits of the enlarged platform you've created in North America? Like, are we already seeing some bolt-ons into Ash Grove? And can you discuss experiences in value creation or the differences between smaller deals and the larger ones you've done, and maybe the pipeline there? And switching on to America's products, very impressive, I think, operating leverage. How sustainable is that? And when we look at it in the context of the larger group, how can we get the group level up to similar types of rates?
Okay, so it meant 2.5 questions there, I guess, David. First question on M&A and bolt-ons and last year, where the pace of that, I'll deal with that. Second question was on the delivery last year, America's products. Keith, you might deal with that. And in terms of the leverage of America's products and the ongoing impact on the group, you might just deal with that and then leverage going forward, Senator, if you don't mind. So just with regard to the M&A bolt-on deals last year, just to be clear, it's in the announcement, we did 46 deals last year. We do a deal about every 10 days, 9 days in CRH. And actually, we don't make any fuss about it. They just come in through the door. And actually, last year was a year when I was trying to pull back a bit, actually. We had some big deals to integrate. So that was a year when we fought on the break. And we spent about $650 million on those deals. As Randy said, in our biggest market, 70% of the market is unconsolidated. It's fragmented. We have a long, long list of deals to look at. And the only thing to decide whether we buy them or not is the pace at which we want to buy them and the value we buy them at. Incidentally, the multiple in those deals last year was 6x EBITDA before synergies. That's where the real value creation in CRH is. But you rightly point out about the platforms. The key about CRH is when we buy the platforms, that begets another 10 or 20 years of add-on deals for value creation. Because it's the add-on at 6x and how we consolidate those businesses and pull those smaller businesses in, getting the benefit of professional procurement, proper processes, more service to the market, more ability to service the market. That is, for the last 50 years, what has been behind the delivery of the profit improvement for CRH. So there's no slowdown in the deals. The deals are there. They're focused. It's just a question of what we want to do. And our focus is very much on bedding down the platforms of business that we acquired last year. With regard to the American Products Division, which was a good performance last year, and a good performance leverage-wise, Keith, you might just have a comment on that.
Yeah, just, I think what you saw in 2018 is a continuation of a long-term trend within our products business in Americas of margin improvement. And as you know, obviously, as the margin increases, that's going to flow through as positive operating leverage, you know, or impressive operating leverage. It's really kind of down to a few things, really. A long-term continuous focus on being a more efficient operator, looking at not so much our portfolio of businesses, but looking at our portfolio of products, you know, and aligning our products to higher margin, you know, opportunities in the marketplace and focusing there as changes in the market evolve. And when you look at could we do it going forward, certainly, you know, we've been really focused on it for the last number of years. I think we have 5 or 6 years of improving margins in America's products. And as part of our overall plan for another 300 basis points for CRH, we're putting in a whole new set of plans in terms of cost, productivity, efficiency, commercial excellence to continue the drive of further margin improvement in the division. So, yeah, I would expect – I don't know if the level of operating leverage would be the same going forward, but certainly we have plans in place to continue to improve the margin profile of the business.
And I might just add that I mean, the operating leverage that Keith achieved over the last 12 months in his division is equally achievable in both Randy and Anne's business going forward. I mean, my guidance overall when you look at the group is that you'd expect 2019 to be back at that north of 20% operating leverage again. And we've talked about specifically the reasons why we didn't achieve that in 2018 based on weather and based on input costs, or particularly the spike in input costs. But I think in a more normal environment, you'd expect to see us to go back to what you've seen from us over the previous 5 years.
I think I'll take one more question from the room here. There's quite a number of questions that just come in down the wires there. So, Arnold, please.
Yes. I'm Luc Detel from Onfield Research. I have two questions, if I may. The first one is on the year 2019 and the outlook, just to understand a little bit better the top line, because you see a continuous momentum of Q4. What you see in the Q4 of 2018, you start to the year with similar trends, but is it not just reflecting the leading indicators we had until the third quarter of 2018? When we look at leading indicators in the last quarter of 2018, we see in a lot of markets, residential and non-residential trends, plateauing or trending down. So do you expect 2019 to be a year where H1 is, in terms of top line, better than H2, or is it not the right way to look at it? And my second question is on an update on the European distribution. We see different players trying to sell their distribution assets at the moment. You are one of them. We see interest from apparently from some private equity firms that are looking at this type of asset. It looks like to obtain a fair multiple if you wanted to sell this asset will be probably a little bit challenging in this context. So if you don't get the multiple you want, what could be your other options for the distribution? Thank you.
Okay. So two questions there. One with regard to the run rate exiting last year. Does this indicate something that you're going to get up to a particularly strong start in half one versus half two to get the actual reads through the full year? And the second question was really just an update on where we are on the process of the strategic review of European distribution. On the first question, what we're indicating with regards to the run rate at the start of this year and the tail end of last year is we're, of course, backing out all the factors that impact upon how it can be skewed in one way or the other. Remember, we had a very significant weather disruption, particularly in North America, at our busiest period in August and September. That meant that a lot of that work moved into the start of quarter four. But, of course, we're smart enough to know our business very well and talk to our clients, so we can back that out to get a clear run rate of what the level of activity across our markets actually is. And that's that informs our comments that the pace of growth during the course of last year will continue into this year. And it started out that particular year because, of course, we're reporting results now for 2018 and we can see how February has finished ahead of us. But we have order books, as Randy says, that go out 6 or 9 months. So we already have work planned for April, May, June, July that gives us an indication, provided we have no major weather dislocation again, both in our European and US business, where the run rate for our business is actually coming out. And that's what informs us in terms of the run rate, broadly speaking, continuing on the trend we saw in a normalized half two, not weather impact for skewed. With regard to European distribution and the challenges we're faced with, if you say with getting a multiple on that or not, our only concern is how we decide to allocate this capital. We have an amount of money allocated into European distribution at this moment in time. This is a good business. It makes good profits, it generates good cash, and generates good returns. And for any financial manager, any manager of capital, you've got to look and see, well, what can we do to improve that business? What will it generate in terms of returns and cash? And then dispassionately compare that against what I can crystallize the value of that business for now, and then allocate that elsewhere to create higher returns and cash for our shareholders. And that is exactly the process we're going through. And when we finish that process, and it's not going to take another 6 months, but it's not going to take, it won't be done in 6 weeks either, we will then be able to evaluate those two options and then make the best decision for our shareholders. And when we get there, I promise you, we'll explain why we've done that and what we're going to do very clearly to our shareholders at the appropriate time. Okay, I'll take one more question in the room. Will, sorry, I'm conscious of our time here as well. Sorry, Will.
Thanks. Will Jones from Redburn. Three hopefully quite quick ones if I could, please. The first, just picking up on the cement business in your various geographies, there were a few areas of, I guess, price spats last year, a couple of regions in the US, Switzerland, obviously there's been a few back and forths over the last couple of years. Do you think those areas of tension have kind of played out now? And are there any new areas that might be more competitive, I guess, in your business in 2019? Second, just specifically around the UK, I think the text refers to profits having fallen in the UK last year. No surprises there, but I guess if we were to assume no big disruption from Brexit over the next month or two, do you think you can stabilise the profitability in the UK in 19 or maybe even improve it? And then the last one was just picking up on procurement. I think in November you talked about half of what you intend to do having been identified. The 100 million plus talked about today, what percentage is that of the total, I guess, is that number? Thanks.
Okay. Three questions there. Actually, just in the interest of time, I'm going to deal with the first two myself, which is the cement question. and they're talking about how the UK performed in 2018, 2019. I'll ask Randy at the end to come back and talk about the procurement in terms of the comments with regard to that. Look, the world is not perfect. There are spats in the US, even though the US should be heading north in terms of volumes and prices. Specifically, you're referring to Texas, West Texas, and also you're referring up to the Midwest. We don't really get hurt greatly up in the Midwest and indeed in West Texas. My own sense is these things go on as people jostle against each other and compete. They tend to be more of a temporary in nature. I don't think there's any long-term sustainable issues there with regard to competition within the United States. So I think it's broadly fine. With regard to Europe, actually the Swiss issue was honest. It wasn't really a competition issue. It was the fact that we were locked into long-term contracts. That was more the issue with us, that we couldn't push the price on when the price moved on. Others, it's the timing of the unwinding of the long-term contracts. And I would echo Anna's view that actually I think that actually the sustainability of a sustainable delivery of price increases in Europe is building. Actually, Will, we've been saying this on this stage for 3 years now. This year. We called in 2016, further in 2017, and we're seeing it again in 2018, and again more in 2019. So I think that's just going to continue to push on. And for me now, it's not the question of how often or how broad-spread that price increase is going to be. It's how consistent we get that we're built back up those prices, because the ambition is there. And also, pushed by the higher energy costs, you need to get them. You need to recover them back in the businesses. Randy, just on procurement?
Yeah, I would say we're early days there. Right? It's the organization is in place really probably in total at the beginning of this year, but those identified savings were those categories in which we thought were easy enough for us to attack, had global appeal, and we could deliver on. So I would expect as we go forward, we'll keep you informed in regards to how our progress is there. But it's really category by category over that $18 billion of spend, so more to come.
I'm just going to have to move to some of the questions we've got from the wires, because actually we're out of time. I'm going to give it another 5 minutes. If people are still watching, please stay with us. First question, Randy, you just come in. What your thoughts on the potential for a new U.S. highway bill, not Fast Act, so a new U.S. highway bill, and the update on any state funding initiatives that are currently in place at the moment?
Okay, I'll try to be brief. In 2018, I mentioned we were pleased. In 2018, you had another 19 states who put forward 27 separate initiatives that equated about $6 billion of additional infrastructure spend. Good progress there. There were 570-some ballot initiatives, 470 passed, so roughly 80%. That generated $37 billion of spend over the next decade, some more heavily weighted towards Florida and Texas, but still good momentum there. There is a lot of talk, and certainly with the change in regards to representation, the Democrats took the House, and so the committees, specifically the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, has changed its leadership. Peter DeFazio is from Oregon, is now the chair. He is going to bring forward a bill with his co-chair, Sam Graves, in May of this year that will be pretty substantial in regards to additional funding. It is the industry as a whole, not just our industry, the users, the America's Trucker Association, UPS, FedEx, U.S. Chamber are all on board with a 20 to 25 cent increase in the user fee or the gas tax, the federal gas tax. That will be part of the plan that would be brought forward. And I think critical is that the Trump administration is no longer, and he hasn't said it publicly, but his staff no longer talking about a significant portion of the $1.5 trillion investment being private-public partnerships. It's kind of fixing the highway trust fund. And the way you do that is through the gas tax.
Okay, thank you. Just last question on the U.S. Randy, Keith, excuse me, if I just go to you. Just a question on what's driving the fluctuations in the non-residential market? And maybe I might just add the residential market, your thoughts on that going forward into 2019, just where you see it leading.
Sure, Albert. I think if you think about the non-res market, one thing to remember is it's not a holistic market. It's made up a lot of different sub-segments, office, commercial, institutional, educational, all these different things. And I think what we're seeing now is in a cycle that's now several years old, is some parts of those are maturing faster than others. And so, like in the private side of that, recovered quicker in the commercial arrangements. And now we're seeing kind of a come on in things that are backed by more public money, like schools and other sorts of public buildings. And so I think what you're seeing in the commercial markets and non-res is continued growth, but different pace of growth for different subsegments within non-residential. Certainly our experience has been that we came out of 2018 with a little bit of tailwind in that part of our business, and prospects look good in that for 2019. Just talking with general contractors and people who do a lot of that work, they had very good years last year and very good backlogs coming into 2019. And then the res market, you know, again, it's probably been, as a cycle, slower than most people would have thought in terms of growth, but I think there's still growth in that cycle. The long-term needs of housing in the United States and Canada are being underserved by the current pace of construction. So we're well below any sort of real estimate of long-term averages. I think it's just about reinvigorating that industry, getting the right lot formation and family formation to be able to pull through and fully realize the potential of that. So again, we're not expecting gangbuster growth in residential, but we would see, you know, sort of mid to low single digit growth in residential, both in terms of new construction and actually what's more important to our business in North America is the repair and improvement and maintenance of existing housing. So again, good growth we're expecting going forward, and probably, you know, long term good potential in that market.
Two very specific questions. I'll answer them myself just as they were asked. How is CRL performing? CRL is performing very well, ahead of plan, ahead of budget, and actually giving very good returns. Very pleased with that acquisition. Very specific question. How is France performing? Well, very well, actually. Just three quick questions for you, Senan. Sorry. Impact of IFRS 16, which is an important impact about the numbers next year. Also, in terms of FX outlook for 2019, your own thoughts in terms of what is a lot of headwinds this year and next year, and contribution of bolt-ons in 2018, outlook for 19. You don't know 19, but contribution of bolt-ons.
All right, bolt-ons, take that backwards. Bolt-ons last year, we talked about the 45 deals done, about 650 euros spent on those deals. Multiples on them about 7 times in terms of where they come out. So about 50 million from bolt-ons last year and probably another 40 to be added onto that as you go into 2019. FX, 100 million of currency headwinds last year. That really was mostly US dollar. As you know, dollar moved from 113 average to 118 average. Spot price today at 114. So that would suggest that if it stays at 114 for the year, most of that 100 of headwinds becomes a tailwind for next year. First question, IFRS, yeah, okay. IFRS, look, over the next couple of weeks, the IR team will be available to talk to you about that in more detail. But basically, in summary, what it means is we've got about 600 million of operating lease charges through a deduction in arriving at EBITDA today. Under operating leases, a little bit less than two-thirds of that now will be capitalized going forward. So that would boost our EBITDA by the tune of 350, 400 million in 19. Obviously drive up the margins in a corresponding way. By the time you get to EPS, it has washed itself out because it comes back out in depreciation and higher interest cost. On the balance sheet, likewise, it's a net zero, but it will drive up our assets to the tune of 1.8, 1.9 billion. And likewise, it will drive up our lease liabilities by the same amount and drive up our net debt accordingly. So my simple calculation would be the just under 2.1 times net debt EBITDA on a new norm would become just under 2.4 times. And again, the last thing I'd say on that is that it has more of an impact in terms of our products and distribution businesses than it does in our materials businesses. And that's really by virtue of the fact that that's where we have a lot of buildings and leasehold activity. So about half of the 2 billion or 1.8 billion I mentioned is probably going to be associated with your business, Keith, and the rest then is split fairly evenly between Randy and Ani.
Thanks, Senator. Look, I want to thank you all for your attention this morning. We kept you here a lot longer than we should have. Just to say that we hope you got a clear understanding of what we're doing as a group. It's been a really good year for us in 2018. We've got clear plans to improve our business going forward for next year and in the years beyond. The next time we'll have an opportunity to talk to you is when we give our update trading statement on April the 27th, which is a day in advance of our annual shareholders meeting on April 28th, and we look forward to doing so. But until then, thank you for your attention and have a good day. Thank you.